Welcome to My African Aesthetic, a podcast that interrogates the African aesthetic in African architecture and design.
On this podcast, you'll hear about the work, philosophy, and design process of African architects and designers practicing in Africa and the diaspora.
My name is Eunice Nanzala Schumacher. I'm a Ugandan architect and designer living and working in Norway.
And my name is Penina Achayo-Laker. I am a Ugandan graphic designer, researcher, and educator living and practicing in the USA.
Our podcast features conversations with designers working to provide architecture and design solutions for Africa.
We would like this to become a platform where our guests share their knowledge and experiences on designing in the diverse, hybrid, and dynamic socioeconomic, cultural, and political African context.
We are looking forward to embarking on this journey with you. Welcome to part two of our interview with Abigail from Design Without Borders Africa. She is the head of design at Design Without Borders, and today she will be reflecting and sharing some experiences from her career journey and her work at Design Without Borders. So, Abby, please tell us about this transition from design to architecture. I know that there is no clear line between design and architecture. It's a gray zone, but when did you make this transition and how did you come to make the transition from going away from like architecture to like going into this transdisciplinary practice with Design Without Borders, and how has that journey been?
So for me, I immediately, a few months in, I actually began to do some work with a number of students, master's students from Norway, who were doing a course in urban ecological planning. So how I got into that was the dean of architecture the dean of the School of Engineering, Design and Technology at Makere gave me a call and was saying how there's a number of students who just needed support with their master's projects that they were doing in the different slum settlements in Kampala. And they were going to be in Kampala for a couple of months. And if I was interested, I could be part of supporting them through that process. So I had no idea that this was going to change my entire sort of path in several ways. But it actually did. So we were working together. So together with these students, we did some work in all the different slums, actually, in Kampala as well as Jinja. So it was both to do with low-cost housing solutions as well as sanitation solutions. So we're thinking through really sustainable solutions within slum settlements. And I guess for me, that was the first time I began to see the connection between the arts and the sciences, maybe a bit more, like we were talking about earlier, because in the slums, my goodness, like you begin to really see the implications of design and what bad design can actually do, the harm that bad design can have on people's lives. I think which many times maybe we don't take as seriously if you're sort of just designing a household. You're designing a shopping mall, you know, or you're designing another bungalow or something. You're not really thinking about it in that extremity as such. But when you're deep in the slum and you realize how just because the drainage is going in this direction, it's creating cholera, and you know how many families are going to die as a result of that, it sort of changes your perspective completely. So like that experience for me was very eye-opening. I remember, for one, it also really opened my mind in terms of understanding how do you respond effectively to needs, to like understanding people and how they live and designing appropriately for that, because I think the way that we were sort of trained in school, it was more you would want to leave a mark, like I was saying previously. You know, you get out trying to leave your mark, to sort of put your statement. You know, this is the African aesthetic that we're on right now, you know. So it's sort of, what is my aesthetic? And you want it to be visible and I thought, what's my signature, you know? And throughout art school, every single presentation you'd make, they would ask you, you know, what's your concept? How is your concept visible in the building? What was your inspiration for it? And, you know, a lot of the time you had to really wow the lecturers with this really grand idea that, you know, when you see it going up in this way, you know, very dramatic. But in the real world, you can't be, I mean, a lot more function, the whole discussion and debate about form follows function and form anyway. Like the function issue, especially in when you're thinking about poverty and or you're thinking about challenging contexts, really function at that time begins to really drive the discussion, right? So I guess for me at the time it really opened my eyes, because in one of these slums we found one of these really beautiful buildings that had been put up by and donated by one of these NGO organizations from abroad who come in, you know, design and build this community like center, and finished it up and left, you know. And part of the community center was some sanitation, so some toilets right at the basement level, and then had like a community center at the top, and then some classrooms at another level of the building. Anyway, so the idea was, you know, have this building where people can have better toilets in the slum. At the same time, they can have space where they can have community meetings. And then the school, which usually maybe meets under the tree, can also utilize some of the space upstairs for their classes, etc. So it seemed like a really, really brilliant design. But what was funny was for us, when we went into the slum and were visiting and moving through and trying to understand the challenges and all of that, we found that people were actually living inside the toilet. So the different cubicles, which were designated for like the male and female, and then the persons with disability toilet as well, that was actually a bigger home. So the person who took up the PWD toilet had like a bigger room. So I was actually paying a bit more for that space for his house, in quotes. So, but then the other smaller cubicles that are where the toilet sits, each was a house, like each was a home. I don't know if you get what I mean. So for me, I was really astounded by it, because someone actually lays their bed in that small 1 or 900 millimeter, you know, width corridor-like space or cubicle space, and they're able to put in a bed and sleep on the floor. And the next person has the same, you know. It was very, very telling. And I think at the time one of the statements from the community was, how can I have a toilet that looks better than my home? So what had happened was, because they already had, like a lot of the people in the community had, you know, your roof is leaking when it rains, your floor is basically water is caving in, everything, you know. So, and then these guys have built this beautiful building which houses a toilet and etc. The toilet was in a much better condition than their home. So they moved into the toilet. So anyway, that experience just changed my complete perspective of architecture, of design, I think in general, because I began to feel that, okay, we need to pay a bit more attention to these kinds of issues, and to also really be more attentive to the impact of our design from a larger perspective of, you know, people, and really thinking about the country that I'm in. Because I guess for me, I just kept thinking about, what about those people, you know, who is designing for them? And yet they happen to be the majority, right? So I have nothing against the beautiful, you know, the new buildings and the experimentation that people are doing, you know, in Kampala, in the different city suburbs and all over, you know, Mbarara and with the tourism and ETC. And I think that's really beautiful and very, and I think that's really great. But I think for me at that time, my heart was like, okay, someone needs to be thinking about these other people, you know, and yeah, and like, how can architecture also serve this part of the population who are living in really difficult conditions, or who have maybe been, who, you know, they didn't choose to be where they are, you know, and but have their various struggles. And I mean, in a country like ours, like I was saying, they are the majority, you know. So how do we as a profession begin to adapt, you know, to actually be able to fit well and to serve the needs of those as well? Anyway, so I guess for me, that began to be my shift. So after engaging with those students, and we developed a number of interesting solutions as a result, then I later got into Design Without Borders. And it just felt like the stars just began to align in a sense in that direction, because it's like, as I was beginning to feel disgruntled in the architectural world and in mainstream architecture, then I find these students, then I get into Design Without Borders. It's sort of like all just began to unfold in that way. So that's how I guess I began to interface a bit more with design from the perspective of problem solving and sort of understanding people, context, and designing around that. So systems thinking and all of that. So I think that's a bit of how my transition into that began, I guess. Yeah.
Do you feel like you have had to detach from architecture, you know, like while you've transitioned into design, or how does that work for you now? How does that balance between architecture and design work for you in your work at Design Without Borders?
So I would say that it hasn't detached at all from architecture. So for me, it actually just opened my mind a bit more. I feel that while I was in school or while I was practicing, I feel like I was a bit closed-minded in a way. but in my experience, and I guess like you were mentioning a bit earlier, when you begin to collaborate with others from a completely different discipline, different background, oh my goodness, it opens up the opportunities for design in a tremendous way. I would say actually right now, my biggest passion right now is actually like public health and thinking about, you know, design and health and how the two really coexist, you know, that how bad design, like I was saying, the implications of bad design on health is really, it's crazy. I was pregnant a few months ago, like, for lack of a better example to use right now, but I firsthand got to understand how if architects don't take the time to understand or to sit down with some medical doctors or sit down with some pregnant mothers and understand what it's like to go through a hospital when you're pregnant in this country, it's like a death sentence in a way, you know. Like they say that a lot of mothers die in the process of giving birth, or and you know the statistics in this country, they're very painful to see. And I would say that a lot of the reasons, yes, they might be tied to our health services or to equipment, etc., but also a lot of that can be attributed to design. And we have a part to play in that. So architects, designers, we all have a big role to play in that. So I would say that, oh my God, the various issues that I was seeing in the process, I was just dumbfounded, because I'm like, I don't think the architect at the time who was in this building, I won't mention what hospital it was, I don't think they even took the time to understand what it's like for someone to give birth. Like, it's just like this space doesn't work at all, you know? So I would say that for me, it's just opened my mind a lot more. It's allowed me to sort of also think about how important it is for that transdisciplinary collaboration, you know, with architects, with industrial designers, with other professionals, so that if you're designing, you know, a center, you know, getting the people who actually are going to be living in that center or working in that center, whatever that center is supposed to be doing, you know, the people who are going to spend their 8 to 5 every single day to give you input into what exactly, what would make it work, you know, as best as it should. And I feel like for me, that was sort of lacking a lot in the way that I was being trained. And through my work with Design Without Borders, it's built on that. So it sort of opened my eyes even more to the need for that very intentional and sensitivity with the way that we approach design. So I would say at the end of the day, for me, my perspective is the output could vary. So the output can be a building, the output can be a tool, the output can be a device, the output can be an app, the output can be, you know, all sorts of things, but the process is design, you know? So that's why in my perspective, I guess architecture is part of design. It's an output, actually. Okay, that's the way I see it. I guess maybe that could sound very controversial, maybe for some of the very strong protectors of the profession, I guess. But in my perspective, I just feel like it's an output. The output could be a building, it could be anything. But what's more important is the process that led to that output, you know, and that process being, who is it for? What purpose is it serving? And how you've actually been able to incorporate all of that in the development of the solution.
It's interesting the direction that you take when you also talk about the clientele, because professions, in a way, we can also be blinded by, they don't have money, so they're not our client, you know? They're not rich, so then, I mean, they can't afford our fees, so they're not our client. I think in a way we kind of miss out on actually the opportunities. And okay, yeah. And so I'm thinking that sometimes if we open up our minds as designers and architects, knowing that, okay, a hospital, everyone needs a hospital in the country. How about design becomes that welcoming place for everyone in society?
And you know, I would say as well that I think the quality as well shouldn't be compromised on as well. Like you're saying, by opening up and actually realizing that even if, say, our population has a larger majority who wouldn't be able to afford the standard architectural fees, it's for us to actually sit back and think, how do we serve them better? Like, how do we meet them where they are? Or provide a service that they can actually afford without compromising on the quality that's being provided. On the one hand, there have been innovative ways that various people have been thinking about doing this. You know, you never really pay for things as an individual as such. You know, it's a more communal-based approach to living, approach to money as well. We were working on a financial literacy tool sometime not so long ago, and one of the things that we were understanding is also the way money is used in the more traditional or communal settings, you know, that we were brought up in. Money is not mine as such, you know, in a family. You sort of, it's not like an individualistic concept as such, you know. And the way that we respond as well in design and in thinking through solutions, we need to also respond to our cultures, to our context, you know, and thinking about, fine, if people are actually more accustomed to money from a very communal perspective, could we create solutions where perhaps the community is paying for the architectural fees, not one man, you know? Okay, that's very out there. But I'm just saying, you know, those are some of the things that if we begin to take into consideration and understanding how do our cultures work, what does the context say, and also thinking about, you know, even if that, you know, they're more disadvantaged or vulnerable, in our communities, if they too would want something that is beautiful, you know? And the question also is, the beauty isn't from my perspective as a designer as such, it's also how do I respond to what beauty is in their perspective, you know? So it's, I think for me, that was also another shift, a mindset shift, a lot more as I began to work with design, in practice, both here, is in also learning the skill of co-design. So where you're working together with people and identifying the fact that they too can be able to identify solutions that work for them. And they are the ones who are using this thing anyway. So ideally, they should be able to speak to their preferences in terms of aesthetic as well. So I guess very contrary to my training, which was more what is my signature on things, in practice, I'm beginning to learn more how do I identify their signature and design for them, you know, like with them and for them, you know, and not just give them what I would like. You get what I mean? Like, it's so much easier to design something that you think is good according to you, but then you're giving it to someone who might not have the same tastes and preferences. So like, a lot of the times it's also the humility that we were talking about earlier. So that humility in recognizing the fact that I don't have all the answers, and actually in working together with the different disciplines, the different people who will be interfacing with the solutions, if it's a building, if it's a product or a service, that they too actually can be able to speak really appropriately to what the aesthetic should be, as well as the function and etc. So anyway, I guess for me that kind of took me backwards and began to, has really formed a lot of the way that I think these days and the way that I work and really my passions today and all of that. It's really just tied to how can I respond more? How do we design relevant, meaningful, you know, solutions? Yeah.
Abby, wow, there's just so much that you have said. You've packed this conversation with so many great provocations, but also just so many great areas that we can reflect on as a profession. And for me, I think coming to this conversation with you all as a designer, a trained graphic designer who is now interested in, I work a lot in community-based work, and the themes that you brought up regarding co-creation, designing from a place of context and deep empathy, to touching on systems thinking, design, and even transdisciplinary design practices. I am curious to hear from you if you have seen there be a difference in sustainability, or even just like in the impact of the work that you do when you have designed or created solutions from a point of true empathy, but also from a point of co-creation that takes into account not just the aesthetic desires of the people you're working with, but takes into account truly where their needs are and how the solutions fit within this larger ecosystem of their lived experience. What has impact looked like since sort of shifting gears a little bit? Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I would say that sustainability and impact is much, much greater, I think, that way. And then, you know, some of the mistakes that we've been making historically can be addressed through the issues that you mentioned, the transdisciplinarity, the systems thinking, the co-creation, all of these different disciplines or different, I don't know what to call them, approaches, are really valuable to every discipline, I would say, actually. So I wouldn't even say that these should be owned by designers as such or by people within the creative industry. But actually, I would say that all disciplines could borrow, you know, from these principles to actually be better at the work that they're doing and actually create better, you know, solutions if you're in agriculture, if you're, you know, a chemist, if you're whatever it is, you know, that it's actually of value, I would say. And I would say that I think for me, that I have seen that in my practice, in my work with Design Without Borders. I would give an example. I think one of the things that was very, I guess maybe, what's the word to use? Not surprising. It would be, I guess maybe amazing, I guess I would say, was we were working on a project in Adjumani in collaboration with the UNDP and a number of other local actors. And one of the, forgive me actually, one of the things, one of the words I've been trying to avoid saying these days is the word local.
Local in the Ugandan sense, you know, like because local, I think the Ugandan sense has a negative connotation in some ways, but also local is not necessarily a bad thing.
I don't know, you know, I'm not sure because I feel that working a lot, I guess, for me in the more recent past with a lot of maybe interfacing with humanitarian organizations, NGOs, because, you know, their presence is very heavy in our context. And a lot of the jargon or the words that I used, I would say it's problematic, I would say, because most of the times when you make the switch and you say, if I was in Europe, would I use these same words to refer to the people or to refer to the work that I'm doing? Actually wouldn't. So then you kind of question, why do we use those words here then? You know, it's like, it really is, it's one of those things that I when we're having these discussions, it kind of began to like switch on a different switch for me in my mind, because it's very, like we were saying, the humility going in and working with people. I think recognizing that people are people, you know, that we are working with people. They're human beings just like I am, right? And I guess for me also, in my experience working in Norway as well as working here in Uganda, I think for me one of the things that just cements that as well is just recognizing that people are people, you know. They have, yes, we might have very a couple of differences here and there tied to our locations and etc that we need to respond effectively to with in design. But at the end of the day, it's people. We're people and we're human beings, and treating people like human beings as opposed to treating them like, oh, let me help these guys who are, you know, so like that perspective as well. I try my best to really to remember that they're human beings. So even when I'm talking about my brothers and sisters who are deep in the north, you know, who were struggling with Oniwo for over 20 years and for several reasons, you know, they're struggling, you know, to actually have sustainable livelihoods, or the people that we've been talking about, you know, in the different parts of the world who have various challenges, maybe who have had to up and leave their homes because of a hurricane or because of a landslide, or, you know, just realizing that by working and trying to think about innovative solutions and all of that, that's to support and to help our fellow human beings, you know, and support the fellow brother and sister who, I mean, if you were in that place as well, you would sort of desire that same kind of treatment.
I also think that it puts the user or the client in this case, if they are from a rural village, for example, or even just in Kampala, it always puts the client in a, as if they are lower. It doesn't, they're not actually presented as a client. That's what I'm trying to say. Instead, you begin to design solutions for them as if you're always doing it just to assist them. This is aid. And yet, if we look at our communities, if we look at our contexts as if they were a paying client,
and design solutions for them as if they are paying us top notch. It's a different idea. It's a different approach, I feel. And I feel like locals and indigenous people or like such words, I understand that they're actually the right words. And many people actually, there are some people that are very proud to be locals. But I think in Uganda, it's like the local architecture or the local supermarket or anything local is a connotation, I think, that many Ugandans do not associate positivity with it. It's like downgrading them.
No, I think that's good though, Abby. I think you're definitely speaking to, I think some of these criticisms are valid in our industry, in education, that, you know, I don't think we do as good of a job to have conversations or even interrogate. Just maybe like the word I would say is our posturing or positionality when we come to some of these, when we're put in this context. So when you are working in a context with a community or people that are have a completely different lived experience from you, how do you make sure you are coming in, like you were saying, with humility and just even like honoring how they refer to themselves, if you're talking about language and how people see themselves, like you coming to the context and honoring that versus putting your own label on them with your own bias or preconceived notions of what you think of, say, people in a developing world context. So how do we shift those conversations and power structures and start to really see that relationship as one that you know is more on that same footing of co-creation versus, you know, I think some of the humanitarian languages speaks this idea of we're going in to serve or like to help or to alleviate something, you know? And I think because from the get-go, people that work in these spaces have that mindset of, yes, I'm coming in because I am equipped with the ability to help another person. So you almost mm-hmm. used to see them in their own dignity and start to see them as needing your help. And yet mm-hmm. Yes. The power is very one-sided. So I think these are conversations we should be having, like right in, I think, in architecture school, design school, like, you know, early before you even get into professional practice, we need to be interrogating what it means for us to work in different contexts and to work with people, to work with humans. You know, what does it mean to not forget that you're not just this machine that's coming in to spit out this amazing design or building a product, but this should be relational. It should be a relational, not just transactional relationship, if that kind of makes sense. Mm.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, actually, for me, my pain these days, my pain is that some people don't see that, you know, they don't take time to sort of recognize the existence of those power dynamics that exist even within the language that they're using. So many times, oh my goodness, it just like rubs me off the wrong way. Cause I'm like, you are a human being just like I am, you know, and we can work together, you know, and trying to, and also like you're saying, the mindset that you have the all the technical skills to come and help and serve, you know, it's very true what you're saying. But a lot of the times we really need to reflect and think back about how am I responding? What's my posture in this whole thing, you know? And I guess for me, like one of the things that I was about to mention from a project that we're working on in Adjumani, so it was together with refugees and host community in Adjumani. And I think one of the reasons for the project was because of course, within that kind of area, a lot of the times with the influx of refugees and, you know, Uganda are now very open policies, a lot of the times there begins to be some conflict within the communities that they find. So the refugees come in and find these host communities. And a lot of the times the communities that they're moving into, the resources already are limited. So the already limited resources are going to now be shared by even more people. So there's a bit of friction there. So part of the idea was, how can we use design to alleviate that conflict, or not alleviate, but at least begin to at least address this friction and begin to get these people to sort of begin to understand that, you know what, we're both people, we both we have, you know, different unique challenges, but we're here together in the same community and we can begin to work together. So what we did in that project was to actually train the both host community and refugees in design. So we did some design thinking and design training sort of workshops. So where we were actually just teaching design, but mentoring as well. So mentoring them through various projects that they would develop along the way. So what we've been speaking about, the whole idea that people cannot come up with solutions themselves or don't have solutions already existing, and you're sort of the brains that's coming in to give the solution. It's very warped, because like in that particular project that I'm mentioning, my goodness, the different, so each of the participants sort of created their own groups and went into the community, their community, and spoke to people within their community, and sort of putting on the lens of design and problem solving, and began to sort of identify ways in which they can work together and come up with innovative solutions. And some of them, you know, came up with some pretty cool farm products, like farming and farming tools. Another group sort of came up with communication messages to address, you know, reproductive health challenges in the community. Others came up with, anyway, so like each group had a completely different issue that they were trying to target. And these were issues that they identified themselves, and they came up with the solutions themselves. All we were doing there was just sharing with them design skills, sharing with them the process that we would go through in a typical project that we would do, and sharing those skills. And as a result, you know, they were coming up with various innovative solutions in the community themselves. I was recently speaking to one of the local leaders in Adjumani, and she was saying to me the perspective, like, so aside from the solutions that were coming up, yes, that was a great thing, but she was saying how just the confidence that it builds, you know, the resilience, you know, because suddenly you're not just waiting for someone to come and give to you this aid, support, but you're kind of being empowered in a way to realize I actually have it within myself to be able to do this. It just so happens that Abigail, who went to school, who was lucky enough to get trained in school and whatnot, is here to work with us on this. But other than that, we're pretty much the same, you know. So in just sharing the skills that we have with other people who may not necessarily have the same access, it was remarkable to see what that can do. So it was really brilliant, because a lot of the solutions later on, there was a group that sort of came up with a way to address the school dropouts, because a lot of the time, you know, during for the different term periods, many students would sort of drop out because of school fees. So one of the groups in our training came up with a solution where they designed several work opportunities that they would do in the holiday season. And together as a group, as they work on these activities, all the money that they make would sort of go to a fund for school fees for themselves, you know? Anyway, so like they would come up with, and that's really a simple thing. It's not like a grand, I don't know what, but it's a solution that works. It doesn't require any income, like it doesn't require any resource injection, like to make it work. It just allows them to identify opportunities in a community where they can work. So use their hands, if it's bricklaying, if it's, you know, they came up with various opportunities in the community and tasked themselves, and then all the money would be collected. And anyway, so it's just, it was remarkable to see that, sometimes we are sort of hoarding the skills that we have, because, and like, oh, it makes us technical and makes us experts, you know? So that's another word that's disturbing as well, right? Because when you're an expert, you sort of are sitting in your high chair and no one can reach you from there, right? But in realizing that, you know what, I have this skill because I've been exposed to these kinds of training or to these things, and how much better would it be, this world, you know, if we can share as much as we can with the people who are near us, and what that can do in their own disciplines or in their own, you know, space of work or communities as well. It's amazing what that can do. So I'm just thinking and reflecting a lot about that a bit more these days.
Well, Abby, that was so good. And I think in some ways it's fitting how these last few reflections you've had are a great way to bring us full circle, in some ways back to where we started, as you were reflecting on just your education experience and how, if from the time we are learning, we are sort of taught how to sort of be more self-serving in the way we learn, it's completely going to be out of touch with the real world context. So it's important that I'm taking away from this conversation that we need to do a much better job of reimagining how we train young and upcoming designers and architects to not just be so focused on developing their skills and to, if we're truly saying that form follows function, we need to define what function means, but we also need to not remove people from function. Because it's one thing to say, oh, I'm going to create this beautiful thing and it's going to be functional, but can we really interrogate what function is and not remove the people that will actually use the product or service at the end of the day? So for me, it's bringing me back full circle, what we kind of started talking about, and I'm going to let Eunice jump in here as we sort of wrap up this time. I wish we had more time to talk, but it sounds like there is so much more that it won't surprise me if we end up having another conversation in the near future.
I just have one more question just to conclude, and that is what do you find most encouraging about African designers and architects at the moment?
That's a good question. That is a very, very good one. What do I find most encouraging? I think I am really, really excited that there's a bit more recognition of the talent and the brilliance that exists on this continent, you know. I think for a long time the lights had been off, or there had been this misconstrued, you know, perspective that there's no design in Africa, or you know, that kind of jargon that's really misleading. And I would say I'm really excited, because maybe not even just recently, but I mean the past 15, 20 or so years, I think that's been, I mean, I've not been living on this earth for a long time, let's just say, but I think it's really remarkable to see that people are being recognized, that there's the light is being shined onto the African continent a lot more than it was before. On the one hand, that can also be worrying because of the different kinds of vices it can attract as well. But I think it's great. I think that there's a lot of remarkable designers, a lot of remarkable architects, people with creatives. We currently, Design Without Borders, we currently moved into a building filled with creatives, you know, animators, some, you know, fine artists and filmmakers, and anyway, so like really interesting group of people. So the building is called Motive. So anyway, it's quite brilliant, the concept, but it's basically co-working space together with creatives from different fields. And it's amazing to see the work that they're doing. It's amazing to see the work that that people are doing, you know. And I think many times maybe we take that for granted, or we forget that we are in a country, I mean, on a continent that's extremely resourceful, you know, and the access to the beauty, like we were talking about much earlier on in the conversation, is immense, you know. The resources are immense. The opportunities are crazy, are remarkable. So I would say one of the things that's also really great on our continent is the number of young people and the number of opportunities. And I'm seeing a lot more people, you know, waking up and sort of taking a stand and going at it, you know, with all of their might. Which is really brilliant to see. And I hope that even more and more that drive and that energy that has been awakened on our continent may continue to thrive. I know that there's a lot of conversation, especially within the business context, about, you know, how can we ensure that a lot of the businesses and entrepreneurs who are getting, you know, into this space, either within design or other fields, how can they be more sustainable, and beginning to see how that is a discussion that we're having now a bit more, which is good. I know that, I mean, on the one hand, yes, there have been, you know, the data that shows a lot of businesses that fail really quickly from the many that are starting. But I'm not discouraged by that, because at the same time, I think a lot of innovations are happening on the continent. But one of the things that I hope that will improve as well is, I guess, our governance and our systems, because a lot of that sets the tone for our education. A lot of that sets the tone for the accessibility and quality of services for businesses, for the field in which, you know, the architects, the designers who work on the continent. A lot of these things are affected by our leadership, by the governance within our countries, which of course you're aware, you know, we're right in the middle of right at the beginning of the electoral season here in Uganda. And many times, I guess, designers or creatives, we try to steer away from those kinds of conversations. And yet it's so impactful on our practice. It's impactful on the setting. It's impactful on the services and the systems that we interact with on a day-to-day basis. So I would say that that's one of the things that I hope designers will begin to speak more about and begin to play critical roles as well in that space as well, because it really defines a lot of the field and the space that we walk in. But overall, I would say that it's really exciting. I would say it's really exciting to be here, you know. I think I had a couple of friends who were wondering, why would you leave Norway? You know, the safety, you're not coming to this country with the potholes and the bad infrastructure, etc. I'm like, do you not realize the opportunities that are on this continent? You know, it's tremendous. So I am happy to be here. I'm happy to be part of you know, this great, you know, revolution, and what's happening is really tremendous. I'll just say that the world just needs to keep an eye, you know. There's a lot going on and it's brilliant to see.
Thank you so much, Abby, and I think in some ways it's part of the reason why Eunice and I just wanted to start this podcast, so we can create a platform for people to hear from people like you who are working on ground. I don't want to say like at the front lines per se, because you're working at home and you know, you're committed to home and you're committed to being a part of that narrative, changing the paradigm and elevating the brilliance, the beauty of just like all things Ugandan, African design, and we hope to continue to not only highlight your work, philosophy, and all the different initiatives you're doing, but also to provide a space to interrogate, to talk about our differences, to talk about what's possible, what's discouraging, what's encouraging, where we can imagine our education, where we can really start to take ownership of our own stories and be the authors of those stories. So I thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. We are so thankful to have this great chance to start just chipping away at so many layers. You know, it's so deep, but we are excited to be able to bring this to our listeners, and I'm sure that
for all the younger upcoming designers or architects, or that person that might think, I'm interested in this field, but perhaps I can't handle architecture school, that some of what you've said and shared today will change their mindset and give them that final boost they need to just jump in. And for people to realize that, yeah, I think so, Abby, I think so. And because this is how it starts, you know, I think a lot of us had mentors. At least you can identify someone along your path that helped you rethink things. And I think for people out there, this just might be it for them. So I am confident that someone might stumble on this podcast one day. We didn't have this growing up. I don't remember having a podcast or having like a video, something I could watch and listen to people just keeping it real about his experiences. So I think so.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please join us for more conversations and interviews with African educators, creatives, architects, urban planners, and designers as they share their knowledge and experiences about practicing in Africa and the diaspora.
Remember to subscribe, leave a review, or share this podcast with other people that might be interested in this content. Thank you for joining us today.